Brothers and sisters, we're ready for our second class. Our speaker is Brother Jim Stiles. The theme for Brother Stiles' class this week is Jeremiah, Change Before the End Comes. Today's class title is Redirecting Your Life for God.
Good morning, everyone. Jeremiah has always been a favorite subject for me. I spent probably a good part of my life looking at Jeremiah over time. It was one of those books that I always found fascinating because it's like one of the longest books in the Bible. It was always skipped in Sunday school. Nobody ever covered Jeremiah. We knew nothing about Jeremiah. You try to read it yourself and you find out it's so out of order that you wonder if there's any hope of putting this whole thing back together again. It just was one of those books that's almost like a study of Revelation. You throw it in the back and say, well, someday I'll get to that. Someday I'll get to that. But what I gave you today, just so you know on the handouts, and by the way, for those of you listening on tapes, because I happen to be a tape listener myself, I like to listen to a lot of tapes, and if those of you that are hearing on tapes would like copies of the notes, if you just email me at jimstiles10@yahoo.com, I will be glad to send you a packet of the notes. It's always fun to have the notes when you're listening to the tapes as well. This handout is something that I developed just for myself, was trying to keep straight what was happening in the story of Jeremiah. And I like to keep little notes in my Bible, little pages and books, and jot down things as we do the readings and you have different studies. And that was done years ago. You can tell just from the type that that was done on an IBM typewriter. That was before the computers and word processors all came out. Oh, thank you, Paul. Never checked it out. Terrible. See if we can get it in focus, too. Yeah. That always helps. All right. And I hope you all can see that. Or as Brother Peter said, you can always move, right? I like that. some of you may want to move. All that is an attempt to keep track of chronologically, time-wise, what was happening in the book of Jeremiah because the chapters are so out of order. Here's a summary of some of the events. Jeremiah actually starts out prophesying in the 13th year of Josiah. So here we have the kings of Judah coming along this bar here. And then here's a list of different events that happen in the story of Jeremiah, as well as some of the things that are in Kings and Chronicles that fill in a little bit of the gaps. And over on the side here, here are the chapters of Jeremiah that seem to fit in with those. And you'll see how out of order those things are. We got Nebuchadnezzar's reign over here on the side. And they're definitely out of order. Although the first 20 chapters seem to be fairly well in sequence. It's after chapter 20 that we run into trouble and things start moving around into a different order. But the first 20 chapters aren't too bad. And if you're wondering about the little asterisks along the side right there, those are major events. You'll notice that a lot of Jeremiah's prophecies are clumped around the asterisk areas. They're clumped around the invasions. Because what was happening is Jeremiah would come along and he would try to catch the people when he realized some major event was going to happen. There's going to be a big political upheaval. Something's going to occur. The king of Egypt's going to be coming up. The king from the north's going to be coming down. Something's going to be happening. And a lot of Jeremiah's prophecies are clumped around the captivities. It's interesting to note there that many of them are in that situation there, and you can see why. That was a big event. You know, a foreign king would come down. They'd invade the land. They'd be carrying away the Daniels. They'd take away the Ezekiels. They'd take away all the good figs. And the people left in the land would be wondering, what in the world is going on? And so Jeremiah would come in at that point and he'd deliver a lot of his prophecies and try to influence the next king to try to prevent the same kind of thing from happening again. Or at the end, to try to prevent Zedekiah. He's going to try to prevent him from the end disaster that he knows is coming. And he tries his best. In fact, if you're wondering, and chronologically, as Brother Lee mentioned yesterday, we're going to try to put all these things in the chronological order. We could spend forever doing that. You may wonder, like, why? Why is the book so out of chronological order? The best explanation I've seen on that in all the reading that I've done was in Speaker's Commentary, or what we call in the United States here, Cook's, because it's edited by F.C. Cook. And their suggestion was that what Jeremiah did is he compiled, at the end of Zedekiah's life, he compiled prophecies that he had given at different time periods, in the times of Josiah, or Jehoahaz or Jehoiakim. And he took these prophecies and recompiled them in a thematic way to try to impress Zedekiah that, look, here's what I told Josiah, you know what happened. Here's what I told Jehoiakim, you know what happened. Here's what I said earlier in your life, Zedekiah, and you know what happened, and now if you don't change, it's all over. And it's an interesting way of looking at that. When you get into chapters in the 20s and the 30s, you'll see how some of that really rings true. That you wonder, like, why does he switch from king to king to king? It seems to be, it's put together more in a thematic way to try to impress Zedekiah at the end, that Zedekiah, you're the last chance, you're the last one, and if you don't make the changes, this is the end of the kingdom. So that's just a suggestion that was in Speaker's commentary, or Cook's, and that was quite useful. I found that quite useful. It seems to fit a lot of the things that happened. For those of you that are interested in doing a study of Jeremiah, I think it's always nice to know like what kind of reference books are out there, and I can just tell you what I found helpful. There is a book put out by the CMPA that's on Jeremiah by Brother C.C. Walker. Brother Harry Whitaker has written a little book. It's called Of Whom the World Was Not Worthy, which I found very interesting. It's easy reading, and he approaches it more from a thematic point of view. Very good. In fact, the handout that you have on the family of Jeremiah, this little handout right here, most of that came from Brother Harry Whitaker's book, with only some slight modifications. When Brother Ron Cowie was in the Detroit area a couple of years ago, I talked to him about that, and he said he was convinced, as I was, that the family of Shaphan can be added into this chronology. Brother Harry's chart sort of stops right there. If you ever look in the back of his book, he's got this is copied right out of his book. But we're convinced that Shaphan, who's described as the son of Azaliah, that he was probably of this same family line. And when you start looking through some of those names this week, you'll get familiar with those names. Here's Jeremiah right over here, who is the son of Hilkiah, who's probably the Hilkiah, who's the high priest. And you can start to look through the names here. You'll see a lot of the people in the story of Jeremiah, a lot of them are related, which is a good lesson for those of you that come from big families, like some of us do, where every so often we take the flack of the fact that we've got these big families and people think that our big families are like really influential, and what we really know is big families, a lot of times there's a lot of infighting, there's a lot of disagreement, there's a lot of times where we don't get along, and what you are going to see in Jeremiah's family is exactly that. Jeremiah's family, they were split all over the place. We have some people that are extremely faithful, Hilkiah the high priest, Jeremiah himself. You see Barak writing down here. Barak, who was the one who copied down his writings. You look down the line and some of the high priests that came along. Here's Seraiah, who's Ezra's dad, who was killed at the captivity. And Ezra comes along in this same family line. The only difference I would do with Brother Whitaker is he has Ezra right here, and you'll notice that I changed that on your handout on the blue sheet, and Ezra actually comes up here off of Seraiah. I think probably Ezra and Jehozadak were probably brothers. Ezra is always described as the son of Seraiah, every time in the Bible. And if you're wondering why some of our writers push him down further, it's to deal with the chronology in the story of Ezra, depending on what you think the kings were, as to who the kings are in the story of Ezra. If you go with the later Artaxerxes, you have to push Ezra further down, or he's way too old and couldn't possibly have been the son of Seraiah. But the Bible always describes Ezra as the son of Seraiah. And over here, this whole family line here coming down from Azaliah, Shaphan. You're going to see Shaphan in the story in Kings. We see that Shaphan, we were looking at yesterday in 2 Chronicles 34, Shaphan is extremely involved in the temple work and trying to restore the proper worship of Yahweh in the land. He has four sons, three of which are extremely influential in Jeremiah's life. They provided him with great opportunities to come in and be involved and being able to have the opportunity of delivering his prophecies. And even some of their sons, Micaiah and Gedaliah, this Gedaliah right here, who's the grandson of Shaphan, these were all people that were very useful and very good, godly people in the midst of a terrible time in Israel's history. And the only one that we know of over here, this Jaazaniah, for those of you who, you know, raising children, you get a little discouraged once in a while because our children are so different, and you wonder, like, why can't they all just walk along the same road? Shaphan's a good study for that because three of his children and two of his grandchildren were very good, but this fellow right here, Jaazaniah, he shows up in Ezekiel 8, and he's one of those who's involved in worshiping the paintings on the walls of the lizards and all the different things that were going on. This son was definitely wayward at this point, and what happened with him, we really don't know. But it's just one of those warnings that God calls, and it's his election. And so we do the best that we can, and Chapin was an extremely godly person, raised good family, but one of his children was literally off the wall over there. That's the family. This will be a very useful handout, I think, during the week as we start referring to people. You might want to use that as a little cheat sheet to keep track of what's happening in Jeremiah's family. As far as the kings go that we're going to be running into in our study of Jeremiah, we only have to keep track of five kings. These are the last kings of Judah. Unfortunately, four of them start with J's, and it gets really confusing at the end. All the Canadians remember that Zedekiah was last because their alphabet goes from A to Z. It helps them out. But for us, we hopefully remember Zedekiah as our last king. That's the sequence of the last kings to the captivity. Josiah, we looked at yesterday in the introductory talk and looked at some of the background to Josiah's coming on the scene. Someone who was extremely dedicated. He was committed to trying to pull off not just reforms for his time, but I'm really convinced that Josiah was the kind of person who had visions of the future, and he was trying to make sure that he could push his reforms further down the line because he believed Jeremiah. He believed what Jeremiah was saying. Jeremiah said, don't worry about Egypt. Don't worry about the south. That isn't the problem. The problem is the north. Evil is going to break out from the north, and you'll see this all the time through Jeremiah's prophecies. And when Jeremiah is saying this, up in the north right now, and Jeremiah is saying these things about worrying about the north, the Jews in the land were not worried about the north. They were worried about Egypt down in the south. And you remember what happened. Josiah gave his life when Pharaoh Necho came up from the south, and he's coming up to go up to Carchemish, and he's going up to meet the Babylonian king up there, and the Persians, the armies that had developed up there, and they're going to battle at Carchemish. And the Babylonians are up there ready to fight. And you wonder, like, what is Josiah doing at the end of his life, stopping Pharaoh Necho on his way up there? Pharaoh's going to go up and fight Carchemish. And Pharaoh says to Josiah, he says, Josiah, what are you doing? This battle's not with you. I don't want to fight you. I'm going up there to fight. Why would Josiah get involved in a war that wasn't even his if he didn't believe what Jeremiah said, that the evil was going to break out from the north? And it's like Josiah is trying in a last-ditch effort to try and buy time, to please the northern armies that were up there, to please the king of Babylon and let him realize, look, I tried to help you out. And Josiah ends up losing his life in the battle. That's the only thing that makes sense to me as to what would happen at the end of Josiah's life. If you've ever puzzled over that problem of why did he ever do it, it fits in really well with his long-term objectives. He believed Jeremiah. He was committed to the long term, trying to turn around things that were going on in this nation, that which was bent on evil, and which Jeremiah made it very clear that an army from the north, a lion, a fire, is going to come down and burn through the land. And Jeremiah saw these visions of the land totally destroyed and wiped out, and he did the best that he could to try to prevent this from happening. So when Pharaoh Necho comes back down, because the first battle, Pharaoh's involved in, and they win. And he comes back down through the land, and the people of the land had put in Jehoahaz as king, and Pharaoh Necho takes Jehoahaz, takes him right on down to Egypt, and Jehoahaz never comes back to the land again. In fact, he comes up in one of the prophecies in Jeremiah 22, and Jeremiah delivers a prophecy and says to the folks in the land, he says, don't weep for this fella. Don't cry for him. He's never coming back. This guy is gone. And Jehoahaz, he went down there after his 3 months' reign. He's never going to come back again to the land. But then what happens is Pharaoh puts in Jehoiakim as king. This is probably one of the worst kings that Judah ever saw, King Jehoiakim. He only reigns 11 years. At the end of his life, it seems as though when you put all the pieces together at the end of Jehoiakim's life, that the Babylonians had come down again at the end of his life, and there was another siege of the city. And the siege was so bad, the famine that was involved in the land, the siege was so terrible that the people were just like, as the bodies would die, they would just throw them out over the wall, and they would just be scattered out there around the walls of the city of Jerusalem. And Jeremiah prophesied that man, King Jehoiakim, he was so bad, that's what he was going to get. He calls it the burial of an ass. He's going to be dragged forth and thrown out of the city, and he's going to suffer the cold by night and the heat by day. He was not buried in the city of the kings. He was just left out there. He was so bad. And so then his son, Jehoiachin comes in for a while, and he only reigns for 3 months, and it's like after 3 months, after Jehoiakim was dead, it's all a part of this siege, it's like then the siege was over, the Babylonians came back in again, Jehoiakim, it seems like Jehoiachin just like gives up. He may have actually listened to Jeremiah's prophecies. It's an interesting thread that you can follow through. It's a possibility that he believed Jeremiah's prophecies. And in the end, when Jehoiachin became king, him and his mother, they gave up, they walked out like Jeremiah said, they surrendered to the king of Babylon. This is the man who goes up to Babylon, spends time up there, and then the king of Babylon releases him, and he dines regularly in the end, because he had followed Jeremiah's predictions. And then the king puts in Zedekiah, the Babylonian king puts Zedekiah in, and that's where we're going to end up in our studies of Jeremiah, where Zedekiah is the last king. Now, for those of you that haven't looked at those kings before, you might sort of assume that this is like Josiah, and then his son, and then his son, and then his son, and his son. But that's not actually what ends up happening. The on the back of one of the handouts, here's how you can keep track of who's reigning at the end. And maybe it would have been a good idea to number them on your handout. I think I numbered them at one point when we were doing this with some of the kids because they were having trouble keeping track of who reigned when. Josiah, King Josiah, who pulled off the Reformation, he actually had 4 children, according to the Chronicles. There's Johanan, of which we know nothing, so he may have died early. There's Jehoiakim, Jehoahaz, and Zedekiah. You got to be careful with Jehoahaz. He's sometimes referred to as Shalom. That's what he's referred to. And Zedekiah, his name actually was Mattaniah, but he was changed to Zedekiah. That's actually the sequence that they're given in Chronicles, so it seems as though Jehoiakim was older than Jehoahaz, and Jehoahaz was older than Zedekiah. And then Jehoiakim has a son who's Jehoiachin, and these are the last kings of Judah, and here's your sequence. They've got 1, 2, 3, 4, and then 5. You'll notice it's interesting right there, for those of you that do these studies, when you start looking at the sequence of the kings, when Josiah died, if Johanan was dead at this point and he was gone, you might wonder, like, why didn't the people pick Jehoiakim to be the next king? He was probably the oldest son of Josiah. But they probably knew the fellow was rotten all the way through, and it says very clearly in the Kings and Chronicles account that the people made Jehoahaz the king. That's who they picked. And then when Pharaoh Necho came down and he takes Jehoahaz down to Egypt, he picks Jehoiakim and puts him in charge. He's a good puppet king. He'll do what I say. And he leaves him in charge of the people. And then after he died, then his son took over Jehoiachin. And then after Jehoiachin got surrendered and gave up and went to Babylon, it looks like the king Babylon at that point, Nebuchadnezzar or Nebuzaradan, who was ever down there, put Zedekiah in as king. I also went a little bit further on the chronology, just for any of you that like doing studies of the chronologies and you're wondering like how all this stuff is together. Jehoiachin, he is the fellow that in Jeremiah 22, there's a prophecy that says, write this man down childless, for he will not succeed in having a descendant who will rule on the throne of David. None of his offspring. Now, either that meant that he's going to be childless in the sense that none of his direct children were going to sit on the throne of David at that time. Or it was a conditional prophecy that was given that said, look, because of the wickedness of this man, write him down childless. He won't have a descendant who sits on the throne of David. But because he listened to Jeremiah's message, surrendered and went on up to Babylon, that the conditional prophecy was not fulfilled. And instead it was changed. Because even though none of his children, of which he has Shealtiel and Pedaiah, none of his children sat on the throne of David directly right then, Zerubbabel, who comes along at the time of Ezra, Zerubbabel in our story of Ezra, when the captivity is over and they start coming back down into the land, and Jeshua and Zerubbabel are bringing the people back down, Zerubbabel is a direct descendant of Jehoiachin. He's his grandson. And if you're wondering, well, maybe we can just say that in the end, that although Zerubbabel was, he'd never have a descendant would sit on the throne of Judah and reign in Israel again. The problem is that Zerubbabel shows up in Luke 3 and Matthew 1 in the direct line, whichever way you go to the line of Christ, Zerubbabel's in Mary's line and in Joseph's line. So you have no choice. That one way or the other, Zerubbabel's in the line of Messiah. It's an interesting study when you get, and all this stuff shows up in Jeremiah's prophecies.
So that's some of the things that we'll run into this week, and that's another little handy handout to keep in mind to try and keep straight the kings and Josiah's descendants if you've never looked at that before. Now, our goal today is to have a look mainly at some of this background information in chapter 1. There's so much background to the study of Jeremiah, that's why I cheated yesterday and used the introductory talk for part of that, so that you at least got some of the things that happened back in the past. Because I think it is fun to look back there. We looked at Hezekiah, Manasseh, and Ammon, and that sets the framework for Josiah coming on the scenes. And you can see why the people were so confused. Many of the people, we were talking with yesterday with some of the folks afterwards, that and people realized that if you had grown up during Manasseh's days, 50 years you'd been involved in growing up in Israel, you wouldn't have even known what the true worship of Yahweh was. You would have heard about it. Maybe some of your parents and grandparents, or they'd be talking about, oh, I remember what it was like in the days of Hezekiah. But if you were born 20 years into Manasseh's reign, you could have gone through 30 years of your life never even seeing what true worship is all about. And then Ammon comes along and continues the same thing. But I do think it's encouraging, brothers and sisters, to those of you that are raising children or grandchildren, that even if we make mistakes in our life, and we've made mistakes in the past, and we've made bad choices, maybe we've moved off into isolation and weren't involved in the truth, or maybe we lived in an ecclesial area and we weren't involved in the truth, and then later on we went through a period where we decided our spiritual life was regenerated and we're going to get back on track like Manasseh did at the end, even if we can't influence the next direct generation down because it's gone on too long, it's extremely possible that Manasseh may have influenced Josiah. And it's encouraging to the grandparents that are out there that of all the experience that you've learned over time in the truth, that gather that experience together and work with your grandchildren. Work with all those children in your ecclesia. Be involved in greeting them in Sunday schools and doing the best that we can, having them over, doing the part that we can in ecclesial life, because it's never too late. It's never too late. Even if it might have been too late to reach Ammon, it was not too late to reach the next generation down. And that's one of the encouraging stories that I find, at least in the story of Josiah and looking at what happened. Somehow Josiah comes on the scene, and he is extremely committed from the beginning. And he's not just like a Joash. He's not just doing it because that's what Jehoiada says to do. Josiah was committed because he believed it in his heart. He had developed his own personal relationship with God that stuck with him his entire life. Now, some of the background on Jeremiah, just so you can see like a little bit about where he's involved himself. Jeremiah, when you go back and you study him, he was probably born about the same time as Josiah, as far as the best that we can figure out. It was somewhere in that same period. So Jeremiah would have been born also at that period, at the end of Manasseh's life, when Manasseh had gone through his reformation. He would have seen the beginning of Ammon's reign and realized that Ammon had sent everybody right back. But Jeremiah is born, and we find one at verse 1, that he's the son of Hilkiah, who I really believe is the high priest there, of the priests who were in Anathoth in the land of Benjamin. That's where Jeremiah grew up, over in Anathoth, learning to be a priest. He trained to be a priest. Now, when do priests usually start their work? Well, usually around 25 years old, the priest would get involved. So Jeremiah is probably somewhere up around that time period where he's at least about 25 years old. You can see that he prophesied for at least 40 years. 40 years. So when you get to those stories at the end of Zedekiah, and you see Jeremiah being dropped down into the pit, and he's sitting there and he's sinking in the mire, and you see this man, this is not a 20, 30-year-old man sinking in the mire. This is a 60, 65, 70-year-old man dropped down in there, who after he sits in the mire all the time is so weak that even Melech has to drop down the ropes with the rags on him and literally drag Jeremiah up out of the pits. This is not a young man at that point. This is a man who was committed from beginning to end and gave his entire life in service to this community. You talk about ecclesial service. Jeremiah, to me, he stands as one of the ultimate examples of giving your life for your ecclesia. For an ecclesia who hates you. They hated him. They despised him. They didn't want to hear a word that he had to say. And yet he still gave his life for his ecclesia. You know, what does that say, brothers and sisters, to us when we go home next week and we look at all the problems that we face in our ecclesial life? And there's always troubles in ecclesia. People are going to say things that upset us. Somebody's going to do something that upsets us. And it's so easy to just turn our back and say, well, I'm not going to work with these people. They're God's people. And He wants us to be involved. And just go back and look at Jeremiah's life this week and remember it. Take it home with you. Look at this man and the commitment that he had to this ecclesia of God who hated him and didn't want to hear a word he had to say. And that's all they kept saying. Don't talk to us anymore. We don't want to hear anymore about the word of the Lord. And just, Jeremiah, go away. Go away. That's the way they felt about Jeremiah. And he just kept coming back and coming back. And oh, sure, he's frustrated. You want to look at a man who gets depressed. You can study Jeremiah's life, and we'll do that in the first 20 chapters. He gets extremely frustrated and depressed, like all of us do in ecclesial life. But he kept coming back because he knew it was the right thing to do. He knew it was the right thing, and he was looking forward to the day when things would be different, and somebody had to deliver the message right now. Somebody had to do the work for the sake of the few, the remnant that were there. So he wasn't out there necessarily thinking he was going to convert the whole ecclesia and everybody was going to be on board. He was out there to get the few, the remnant that God had promised that he would keep alive. Take them up to Babylon, regrow the remnant, bring them back down in the land, and there would be better days in Israel coming. And Jeremiah worked for those better days. That's what he did. And he continues his mission then for a long time. Now, you look at his background. Jeremiah had trained to be a prophet, as a priest, rather. He trained to be a priest. He grew up probably at 10 years old, 11 years old, as a young boy, as you see walking around here at Bible school. And from the beginning, his family would have trained him what it's like to be a priest. Now, you think about the life of a priest. Priests, in some ways, they had it pretty good. They didn't have to do the kind of jobs that many of us are involved in, where you're wondering from day to day if you're going to lose your job, or people are constantly making more and more demands of you, and you watch the stresses of life go on. The priests were pretty well taken care of. They had sort of like guaranteed supplies of food for them to eat. They had lodging that was supplied to them. The priests were really, if the community was functioning properly, the priests were really pretty good off. Now, they didn't remember going to make the millions. They were not the high breadwinners of the day, but at least they had food, they had clothing, they had places of shelter when the community was functioning properly. And what God calls him to, you see in chapter 1 at verse 4, the word of the Lord came to me saying, Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were born, I sanctified you, and I ordained you to be a prophet to the nations. Boy, that would have rung in Jeremiah's ears. A prophet. Prophet. You think back, a prophet. Elijah, Elisha, Obadiah, hiding those prophets in the caves, constantly in fear for what's happening. You want me to be a prophet? A prophet. And look at it. He responds like Moses in verse 6. And then I said, "Oh Lord God, behold, I cannot speak. I'm only a youth." Very similar to Moses, feeling like he's only a young person. How could he possibly be a prophet and have an impact on these people? And probably wondering whether he even wanted to be a prophet at this time. But God says to him in verse 7, "Don't say I'm only a youth. For you shall go to all whom I send you. And whatever I command you, you shall speak. Do not be afraid of their faces, for I am with you to deliver you, says the Lord." Look at that promise. I am with you to deliver you, says the Lord. You look down at verse 8, verse 9. The Lord put forth his hand and he touched his mouth, trying to show Jeremiah, look, I'll be with you. I'll put my words in your mouth. It'll be okay. Behold, I put my words in your mouth. And see, I've set you over the nations, over the kingdoms. Here's your mission, Jeremiah. You're going to root out, you're going to pull down, you're going to destroy, and you're going to throw down. You're going to build, and you're going to plant. What a great opportunity. And he's probably thinking, this is great. I'm going to be a prophet to the nations. I'm going to pull down the foreign nations that would destroy Israel. I'm going to rule them out and throw them down. And we're going to build up and plant the ecclesial community in the land. And Israel is going to grow. That's what we would have thought. And it seems like that's what Jeremiah thought too, because this is not quite what he had expected. You see at the end of chapter 1, and he says in verse 17, "Therefore, prepare yourself and arise and speak to them all that I command you. Do not be dismayed before their faces, lest I dismay you before them." See, that was his warning that he gave. He said, Jeremiah, you've got a mission, but you've got to fulfill the mission or else I could dismay you before them. For in verse 18, behold, I have made you this day. It's done. I've made you a fortified city. You're iron pillars, bronze walls against who? Against the whole land. Against the kings of Judah. Against its princes, its priests, and against the people of the land. They will fight against you, but they shall not prevail against you, for I am with you, says the Lord, to deliver you. Imagine being commissioned like that. Not quite what Jeremiah had expected, but you know, he's willing to change his jobs. He's willing. He's the kind of person who's like the soft clay, and he's pliable and he's flexible. And when God sends him in a different direction than an ecclesial life, he doesn't fight it. He says, look, if there's a mission to be done, I'm willing to do it. Here I am, send me. And it's a great kind of attitude to have in ecclesial life. We may have, as younger people, we grow up in ecclesia and we think, oh, I'd love to do this job, or I'd like to do that job, or I'd like to do an ecclesial life. And we get to that point and there's somebody else doing it. And that job's being done. And so we can just sit there and we can always think, well, I just can't wait till I can have that job. Or we can realize there are needs in other areas. Somebody has to do this. Somebody's got to get involved in that area. Maybe we're going to involve in seminars, and that's really not what we were after. Maybe we're going to get involved in some other committees that we really didn't think that was our line. Maybe it's in CYCs and teaching Sunday school and all kinds of work that has to be done in ecclesial life. But we need to be pliable like Jeremiah. See where there are needs in ecclesial life, jump into them, and believe that God will, well, he will bless our efforts. Pray about it, and like Jeremiah, he will help us get that job done. But you know, if we had been there and Jeremiah listening to what Jeremiah was told, would you have ever thought about some of the things that were coming on Jeremiah's life? You look at what happened to this man as you go through his life. He goes out there and he delivers his message and nobody wants to listen. Remember, he got told, you look at that again, I have made you a fortified city, iron pillar, bronze walls. They'll fight against you, but they won't prevail. Now, you just glance ahead at some of the things that Jeremiah is going to face. And we'll look at them in a little more detail later on, but just to get a feel for what this man had to endure. In Jeremiah chapter 11, go up to chapter 11, and what Jeremiah is dealing with in chapter 11, God's told Jeremiah, Jeremiah, quit praying for these people. Stop praying for them. It's over. It's done. The sin of Judah is written with an iron pen. It's etched in stone. It's finished. They're going to go. They're going to go up to Babylon. There's no sense. In Jeremiah 11, he tells them again at verse 14, don't pray for this people or lift up a cry or prayer for them. And Jeremiah, what we're going to see in the first 19 chapters or so, is for at least, especially the first 10, Jeremiah is constantly trying to change God's mind. They're not this bad. They don't need to be destroyed. What do you mean this northern army is going to come down and destroy them? And he's constantly trying to go through and change God's mind on this. Really similar to Moses trying to intercede for the people. But in verse 18, look at what happens. It's the easiest way sometimes for us to see a point is for God to like throw it right into our life. And he does this to us. We might argue out an academic point in ecclesial life, and we'd say, well, here's how I'd raise my children if I had some, or whatever, and we think we know all the answers to how we're going to raise our children. This is when I was like 16, 17, before I had any. And all of a sudden, then, you get married, you have your children, you find out, oh, boy, all that stuff I said back then, I know, how could I take it back? And sometimes it happens in ecclesial life. We might have positions that we take in ecclesial life, where we take positions on some of the controversial issues in the truth about marriage out of the truth or divorce, and we say, oh, I'd never do that, or my kids will never do that. And then what God does, he just throws it right into our life and says, now you face it in your family. And he does that so that we'll look at it seriously from a slightly different perspective. Now look at what he does to Jeremiah here in verse 18. Now the Lord gave me knowledge of it, and I know it, for you showed me their doings. But I was like a docile lamb brought to the slaughter. I did not know that they had devised schemes against me, saying, let us destroy the tree with its fruits. Let us cut him off from the land of the living, that his name may be remembered no more. Jeremiah, he's out there prophesying to these people. He knew they didn't want to hear his message. He's out there trying to change these people. The first 10 chapters, he's giving his life and service. And all of a sudden, God says, Jeremiah, didn't you realize they want to kill you? These people from Anathoth, from your hometown, Jeremiah, some of your own family members. They want to kill you. You look in verse 21, "Therefore, thus says the Lord concerning the men of Anathoth who seek your life, saying, do not prophesy in the name of the Lord, lest you die by our hand." You see, God says, "I'll take care of them. I'll punish these men of Anathoth." And so Jeremiah, you know, that would have been a real shocker to him, that these people, they actually want to kill me over this. People that I'd grown up with, people that I'd worked with when I was younger, and people that were my friends back then. And that's what Jeremiah is starting to realize. You just skip over to chapter 15. Chapter 15 is another one where Jeremiah becomes, it's probably like one of his extremely depressed positions that you run into. In Jeremiah 15, the chapter starts out and God tells Jeremiah, look, even if Moses and Samuel were standing here, I still wouldn't look at these people favorably. Because Jeremiah is attempting to be their intercessor. He wants to be the Moses. He wants to be the Samuel that can stand there on behalf of the people and stop God's wrath from coming into the people. And God just keeps coming back and says, Jeremiah, here's the message you got to deliver. You've got to deliver this message, Jeremiah, that people are going to go because they are so evil. And so you look at in verse 10, for example. Jeremiah, he's just depressed. Woe is me, my mother, that you have borne me, a man of strife and a man of contention to the whole earth. You know, he said, what have I done wrong? I've neither lent for interest, nor have men lent to me for interest, yet every one of them curses me. And this is the way he felt. It's just getting more and more depressed as he sees these visions coming down from the north, the land totally left devastated. He tries to deliver the message. The people just want to kill him over it. And yet the man continues to just faithfully go through and not understanding all the time what's happening, but he's going to try to get through this and do the will of his God. You look at chapter 16, just so you can get a flavor of the life of Jeremiah. Chapter 16, the word of the Lord came to Jeremiah, and now what God's going to say is, Jeremiah, somebody has to live this out. Somebody's got to actually show the people what it's going to be like. Sort of like Ezekiel. Ezekiel's up in Babylon, and Ezekiel's going to go through all these things that he does to try and be a living witness to the people. And he says, Jeremiah, you know, you're the same way. You're going to be a living witness. So here's what you got to do. Verse 2, don't take a wife and have sons and daughters in this place. Now, no sons and daughters. You know, imagine being told that. You know, you can't have any children in this place. Because I want you to be a testimony to the people. I want you to be able to tell them, in verse 3, the reason I'm not having a wife with sons and daughters, I'm not going to have any children right now, is because the children that are born in this place, they're going to be out of here. They're gone. It's not a time to have children. They're all being carried out, and many of them are going to die gruesome deaths when the northern army comes down. Verse 5. Jeremiah, you know, he seems to be a kind of person. He had raised up as a priest. He's the kind of person that likes to go around and talk to people. He's the kind of person who seems to have had friends when he was growing up. But in verse 5, God says to him, do not enter the house of mourning, nor go to lament, or bemoan them. For I have taken away my peace from this people, says the Lord, loving kindness and mercies. Both great and small, they're going to die in this land. They shall not be buried. Neither shall men lament for them, or cut themselves, or make for themselves bald for them. See, this is what was coming on the land. And he says to Jeremiah, you got to live it right now. When people die, when your relatives die right now, when your friends die, when the people in your community die, you can't go in there and mourn for them. And when people ask you, well, Jeremiah, why didn't you go? Why didn't you go? You have to tell them, because this is the way it's going to be for God. When the community is destroyed, when you're taken up to Babylon, we're not going to mourn for you because of the bad choices that you've made. You look down in verse 8. Also, you shall not go into the house of feasting to sit with them, to eat and to drink. Jeremiah is told right here, you can't go to any of their feasts anymore. None of the parties that the people had planned. You can't do that. Why? Because why? When they ask you and they invite you to come to their parties, why do you tell them you can't come? You tell them, Jeremiah, because this is not a time to party. This is not a time to feast. Bad times are coming. This is not going to be good. Now, if you'd been around Jeremiah and you've heard him saying these kind of things, would you find Jeremiah the kind of person that you wanted to spend time with? I mean, really, you look at this man's life. It was extremely depressing. He went to talk to the people, and all he could do is say, terrible things are coming. You know, we can't party now. You shouldn't be mourning for the dead now when you realize that what's happening in the land and how bad it's going to be, and you're worried about one person now and the thousands that are going to die. You know, don't have any children now because the children are going to die in the land and others are going to be carried away captive. And Jeremiah is just saying one thing after the next that is so depressing because of the wickedness of this land. And you can imagine that what happened to Jeremiah is that people would see him coming and they just walk the other way. They'd start saying nasty things about him when he walked in the room. And that's the kind of life that this poor man has been asked to lead. And it just gets worse. You know, we're just beginning here. You know, Jeremiah 16, 7, it just gets worse. And you can see why in the end they threw him down in the pit. They wanted him dead. He goes up to see land later on. They grab him when he's leaving the city and call him a deserter. This is what these people thought about him. You just look over one last one on poor Jeremiah. You look at his wife. In Jeremiah 19, he tries to work out another one of these living parables where he takes a flask, and he's already done Jeremiah 18 about the pots. If the clay won't work, then you just throw it out, and God says, this is what Israel's like. And what he's fashioned for them now in Jeremiah 19 is he says, look, take a clay pot and take one of these potter's vessels in verse 1. Go down to the valley of the sons of Hinnom. And make sure when you go down there, you get all the people. So Jeremiah would get this clay pot. He'd walk out by the potsherd gate, and the people would say, what's Jeremiah doing? What's he doing this time? What's Jeremiah going to do? And people would start following. He takes them down to the valley of Hinnom, and he tells them all that, look, you're like this clay pot. This is what God has fashioned you for. You're fit for destruction. And he takes it and he just throws it out there on the rocks and smashes it to pieces and says, this is what's coming. This is what's coming in this land. And that's what he has to tell them. Verse 9, I will cause them to eat the flesh of their sons and the flesh of their daughters. That's what's going to happen. Verse 8, I will make this city desolate and a hissing. Everyone who passes by will be astonished and hiss because of all of its plagues. And then in chapter 20, Pashur, the son of Immer, the priest who was also the chief governor of the house of the Lord, heard Jeremiah prophesying these things, and Pashur strikes Jeremiah the prophet. He puts him in the stocks right at the gate of Benjamin, which was by the house of the Lord. And here is Jeremiah. For all that he's done for his ecclesia, he's slapped, he's beat, he's locked up in stocks, and they're not the kind of stocks that you see sometimes at amusement parks where you're like sitting there like this. They say that these stocks are things that the word means twisted and contorted, so that you would be bent, your arms would be bent, your legs are bent, in a very uncomfortable position. And where does this happen? Right at the gate where the people were coming in. And everybody's looking in, they're coming in, they're looking at Jeremiah. He got what he deserved. Look at that man. And that's the way he was treated. They laughed at him, they jeered at him. And here's a man who gave his life for his ecclesia. So don't ever go home, brothers and sisters, and feel like you've had it. Look at this man. Just look at what he went through for his ecclesia. They didn't like it at all, but he believed it was the right thing to do. Because there were some who were seeing the other side. And they were going to be the basis for growing the remnant. And he's out there giving his life because he knows that he's got to reach to the some. And he's going to try and get them. And you see in Jeremiah 20, in verse 7, you read those verses now, and you see Jeremiah says, oh Lord, you know, you induced me. The Lord means like, you know, you like deceived me, and I was persuaded. You're stronger than I, and you prevailed. I'm in derision daily. Everybody mocks me. And when I spoke, I cried out, I shouted, violence and plunder. I gave your message. I told them, violence and plunder is coming. And look at what the people are doing. And because the word of the Lord was made to me a reproach and a derision daily, and I said, I will make mention of him. I won't speak anymore in his name. You could see how you would feel. I just don't say anything anymore. But his word was in my heart like a burning fire. It was shut up in my bones. I was weary of holding it back, and I could not. For I heard many mocking, fear on every side. And they report, they say, and we will report it. They just couldn't wait to go tell everybody what Jeremiah had said to get him in more trouble. And all his acquaintances watched to see him stumbling. It was like the Pharisees looking at Christ, just waiting, hearing every word to see what they could use against him. Perhaps he can be induced, and then we'll prevail against him, and we'll take our revenge on him. And that's what this ecclesia thought of Jeremiah.
It's pretty frustrating. And you can see he ends up in chapter 20 and verse 14, this whole section, "I'm cursed with the day that I was born." This man was depressed. And you can see why. And God has to constantly bring him back from his depression. Now, one of the other things I just want to look at this morning on the prophet to the nations, in Jeremiah's mission. It's impressive to know that side of Jeremiah, when you get into the feel of Jeremiah, what it would be like to be him, because none of us could ever say we've been asked to do more than that. You really think about that. In your ecclesial life, when has anybody treated you like that in ecclesial life? I mean, our road that God has asked us to take is not that extreme. And we haven't even got to the end of Jeremiah. We just looked at some of the highlights. But Jeremiah is there to remind all of us, brethren and sisters, we can do it by God's grace. And we do. And this is what God wants us to do in the ecclesia. But you look at this idea of the prophet to the nations, back in chapter 1 at verse 5. That phrase used to puzzle me, because I wonder, like, why would Jeremiah be a prophet to the nations? But what he was doing, his message to the Gentile nations was, God wanted to make sure somebody made it very clear. He wasn't just a prophet to the Jews. Jeremiah's message was going to go out beyond the land. It was going to go up into Babylon. It was going to go down into Egypt. It was going to go to all the nations around Israel, that Yahweh, the God of Israel, who had brought his people up from the land of Egypt and had given them the land of Canaan, Yahweh was removing them from the land. And he had to make that message clear. So Jeremiah is springing out of Jerusalem, this message. Daniel's up in Babylon doing the same thing. The Most High rules in the kingdoms of men and gives it to whomsoever he wills. Daniel wants to make it clear to the Babylonian kings, your gods didn't beat Yahweh. He took his people out of the land. Jeremiah is saying the same message down in the south, because God cared that the people of the world realize that Yahweh had not been beaten at all. Nobody had beaten Yahweh. Bel had not beat him. Nebo had not beat him. But Yahweh had removed his people from the land because the people were so bad. And what better man to deliver that message than a man who was so committed to the people that he would give his life for these people? And this is the man who's delivering the message that Yahweh has to remove his people from the land. And that in turn he delivers the message that the nations themselves will be destroyed as well. And that's part of the... That's part of Jeremiah's message. Well, that's the beginning on this story of Jeremiah. We'll hopefully look at some of the more detail as the week goes on. But I hope you can see there's going to be a lot of fun things to look at and a lot of great family and ecclesial lessons in our studies of Jeremiah.
like to do in ecclesial life. And we get to that point and there's somebody else doing it. And that job's being done. And so we can just sit there and we can always think, well, I just can't wait till I can have that job. Or we can realize there are needs in other areas. Somebody has to do this. Somebody's got to get involved in that area. Maybe we're going to get involved in seminars, and that's really not what we were after. Maybe we're going to get involved in some other committees that we really didn't think that was our line. Maybe it's in CYCs and teaching Sunday school and all kinds of work that has to be done in ecclesial life. But we need to be pliable like Jeremiah. See where there are needs in ecclesial life, jump into them, and believe that God will bless our efforts. Pray about it, and like Jeremiah, He will help us get that job done. But you know, if we had been there and Jeremiah is listening to what Jeremiah was told, would you have ever thought about some of the things that were coming on Jeremiah's life? You look at what happened to this man as you go through his life. He goes out there and he delivers his message and nobody wants to listen. Remember, he got told, you look at that again, I have made you a fortified city, iron pillar, bronze walls. They'll fight against you, but they won't prevail. Now, you just glance ahead at some of the things that Jeremiah is going to face. And we'll look at them in a little more detail later on. But just to get a feel for what this man had to endure. In Jeremiah chapter 11, go up to chapter 11. And what Jeremiah is dealing with in chapter 11, God's told Jeremiah, Jeremiah, quit praying for these people. Stop praying for them. It's over. It's done. The sin of Judah is written with an iron pen. It's etched in stone. It's finished. They're going to go. They're going to go up to Babylon. There's no sense. In Jeremiah 11, he tells them again at verse 14, don't pray for this people or lift up a cry or prayer for them. And Jeremiah, what we're going to see in the first 19 chapters or so, is for at least especially the first 10, Jeremiah is constantly trying to change God's mind. They're not this bad. They don't need to be destroyed. What do you mean this northern army is going to come down and destroy them? And he's constantly trying to go through and change God's mind on this. Really similar to Moses trying to intercede for the people. But in verse 18, now look at what happens. It's the easiest way sometimes for us to see a point is for God to like throw it right into our life. And he does this to us. We might argue out an academic point in ecclesial life, and we'd say, well, here's how I'd raise my children if I had some, or whatever, and we think we know all the answers to how we're going to raise our children. This is when I was like 16, 17, before I had any. And all of a sudden, then, you get married, you have your children, and you find out, oh, boy, all that stuff I said back then, I know, how could I take it back? And sometimes that happens in ecclesial life. We might have positions that we take in ecclesial life, where we take positions on some of the controversial issues in the truth about marriage out of the truth or divorce, and we say, oh, I'd never do that, or my kids will never do that. And then what God does, He just throws it right into our life and says, now you face it in your family. And He does that so that we'll look at it seriously from a slightly different perspective. Now look at what He does to Jeremiah here in verse 18. Now the Lord gave me knowledge of it, and I know it, for you showed me their doings. But I was like a docile lamb brought to the slaughter. I did not know that they had devised schemes against me, saying, let us destroy the tree with its fruits. Let us cut them off from the land of the living, that his name may be remembered no more. Jeremiah, he's out there prophesying to these people. He knew they didn't want to hear his message. He's out there trying to change these people. The first 10 chapters, he's giving his life and service. And all of a sudden, God says, Jeremiah, didn't you realize they want to kill you? These people from Anathoth, from your hometown, Jeremiah, some of your own family members, they want to kill you. You look in verse 21, therefore, thus says the Lord concerning the men of Anathoth who seek your life, saying, do not prophesy in the name of the Lord, lest you die by our hand. You see, God says, I'll take care of them. I'll punish these men of Anathoth. And so Jeremiah, you know, that would have been a real shocker to him, that these people, they actually want to kill me over this. People that I'd grown up with, people that I'd worked with when I was younger, and people that were my friends back then. And that's what Jeremiah is starting to realize. You just skip over to chapter 15. Chapter 15 is another one where Jeremiah becomes, it's probably like one of his extremely depressed positions that you run into in Jeremiah 15. The chapter starts out and God tells Jeremiah, look at, even if Moses and Samuel were standing here, I still wouldn't look at these people favorably. Because Jeremiah is attempting to be their intercessor. He wants to be the Moses. He wants to be the Samuel that can stand there on behalf of the people and stop God's wrath from coming into the people. and God just keeps coming back and says, Jeremiah, here's the message you got to deliver. You've got to deliver this message, Jeremiah, that people are going to go because they are so evil. And so you look at in verse 10, for example, Jeremiah is just depressed. Woe is me, my mother, that you have borne me, a man of strife and a man of contention to the whole earth. You know, he said, what have I done wrong? I've neither lent for interest, nor have men lent to me for interest, yet every one of them curses me. And this is the way he felt. It's just getting more and more depressed as he sees these visions coming down from the north, the land totally left devastated. He tries to deliver the message. The people just want to kill him over it. And yet the man continues to just faithfully go through and not understanding all the time what's happening, but he's going to try to get through this and do the will of his God. You look at chapter 16, just so you can get a flavor of the life of Jeremiah. Chapter 16, the word of the Lord came to Jeremiah, and now what God's going to say is, Jeremiah, somebody has to live this out. Somebody's got to actually show the people what it's going to be like. Sort of like Ezekiel. Ezekiel's up in Babylon, and Ezekiel's going to go through all these things that he does to try and be a living witness to the people. And he says, Jeremiah, you know, you're the same way. You're going to be a living witness. So here's what you got to do. Verse 2, don't take a wife and have sons and daughters in this place. Now, no sons and daughters. You know, imagine being told that. You know, you can't have any children in this place. Because I want you to be a testimony to the people. I want you to be able to tell them, in verse 3, the reason I'm not having a wife with sons and daughters, I'm not going to have any children right now, is because the children that are born in this place, they're going to be out of here. They're gone. It's not a time to have children. They're all being carried out, and many of them are going to die gruesome deaths when the northern army comes down. Verse 5. Jeremiah, you know, he seems to be a kind of person. He had raised up as a priest. He's the kind of person that likes to go around and talk to people. He's the kind of person who seems to have had friends when he was growing up. But in verse 5, God says to him, do not enter the house of mourning, nor go to lament, or bemoan them. For I have taken away my peace from this people, says the Lord, loving kindness and mercies. Both great and small, they're going to die in this land. They shall not be buried. Neither shall men lament for them, or cut themselves, or make for themselves bow for them. See, this is what was coming on the land. And he says to Jeremiah, you got to live it right now. When people die, when your relatives die right now, when your friends die, when the people in your community die, you can't go in there and mourn for them. And when people ask you, well, Jeremiah, why didn't you go? Why didn't you go? You have to tell them, because this is the way it's going to be for God. When the community is destroyed, when you're taken up to Babylon, we're not going to mourn for you because of the bad choices that you've made. You look down in verse 8. Also, you shall not go into the house of feasting to sit with them, to eat and to drink. Jeremiah is told right here, you can't go to any other feast anymore. None of the parties that the people had planned. You can't do that. Why? Because why? When they ask you and they invite you to come to their parties, why do you tell them you can't come? You tell them, Jeremiah, because this is not a time to party. This is not a time to feast. Bad times are coming. This is not going to be good. Now, if you'd been around Jeremiah and you've heard him saying these kind of things, would you find Jeremiah the kind of person that you wanted to spend time with? I mean, really, you look at this man's life. It was extremely depressing. He went to talk to the people, and all he could do is say, terrible things are coming. You know, we can't party now. You shouldn't be mourning for the dead now when you realize that what's happening in the land and how bad it's going to be, and you're worried about one person now and the thousands that are going to die. You know, don't have any children now because the children are going to die in the land and others are going to be carried away captive. And Jeremiah is just saying one thing after the next that is so depressing because of the wickedness of this land. And you can imagine that what happened to Jeremiah is that people would see him coming and they just walk the other way. They start saying nasty things about him when he walked in the room. And that's the kind of life that this poor man has been asked to lead. And it just gets worse. You know, we're just beginning here. You know, Jeremiah 16, 7, it just gets worse. And you can see why in the end they threw him down in the pit. They wanted him dead. He goes up to see land later on. They grab him when he's leaving the city and call him a deserter. This is what these people thought about him. You just look over one last one on poor Jeremiah. You look at his wife. In Jeremiah 19, he tries to work out another one of these living parables where he takes a flask, and he's already done Jeremiah 18 about the pots. If the clay won't work, then you just throw it out, and God says, this is what Israel's like.
And what he's fashioned for them now in Jeremiah 19 is he says, look, take a clay pot and take one of these potter's vessels in verse 1. Go down to the valley of the sons of Hinnom. And make sure when you go down there, you get all the people. So Jeremiah would get this clay pot. He'd walk out by the potsherd gate. And the people would say, what's Jeremiah doing? What's he doing this time? What's Jeremiah going to do? And people would start following him. He takes them down to the valley of Hinnom. And he tells them all that, look, you're like this clay pot. This is what God has fashioned you for. You're fit for destruction. And he takes it and he just throws it out there on the rocks and smashes it to pieces. And says, this is what's coming. This is what's coming in this land. And that's what he has to tell them. Verse 9, I will cause them to eat the flesh of their sons and the flesh of their daughters. That's what's going to happen. Verse 8, I will make this city desolate and a hissing. Everyone who passes by will be astonished and hiss because of all of its plagues. And then in chapter 20, Pasher, the son of Immer, the priest who was also the chief governor of the house of the Lord, heard Jeremiah prophesying these things, and Pasher strikes Jeremiah the prophet. He puts him in the stocks right at the gate of Benjamin, which was by the house of the Lord. And here is Jeremiah. For all that he's done for his ecclesia, he's slapped, he's beat, he's locked up in stocks, and they're not the kind of stocks that you see sometimes at amusement parks, and you're like sitting there like this. They say that these stocks are things that the word means twisted and contorted, so that you would be bent, your arms would be bent, your legs are bent, in a very uncomfortable position. And where does this happen? Right at the gate where the people were coming in. And everybody's looking in, they're coming in, they're looking at Jeremiah. He got what he deserved. Look at that man. And that's the way he was treated. They laughed at him, they jeered at him, and here's a man who gave his life for his ecclesia. So don't ever go home, brothers and sisters, and feel like you've had it. Look at this man. Just look at what he went through for his ecclesia. They didn't like it at all, but he believed it was the right thing to do, because there were some who were seeing the other side, and they were going to be the basis for growing the remnant. And he's out there giving his life because he knows that he's got to reach to the some, and he's going to try and get them. And you see in Jeremiah 20 in verse 7, you read those verses now and you see Jeremiah says, oh Lord, you know, you induced me. The Lord means like, you know, you like deceived me, and I was persuaded. You're stronger than I, and you prevailed. I'm in derision daily. Everybody mocks me. And when I spoke, I cried out, I shouted, violence and plunder. I gave your message. I told them, violence and plunder is coming. And look at what the people are doing. And because the word of the Lord was made to me a reproach and a derision daily, and I said, I will make mention of him. I won't speak anymore in his name. You could see how you would feel. I just don't say anything anymore. But his word was in my heart like a burning fire. It was shut up in my bones. I was weary of holding it back, and I could not. For I heard many mocking, fear on every side. And they report, they say, and we will report it. They just couldn't wait to go tell everybody what Jeremiah had said to get him in more trouble. And all his acquaintances watched to see him stumbling. It was like the Pharisees looking at Christ, just waiting, hearing every word to see what they could use against him. Perhaps he can be induced, and then we'll prevail against him, and we'll take our revenge on him. And that's what this ecclesia thought of Jeremiah. It's pretty frustrating. And you can see he ends up in chapter 20 and verse 14, this whole section, I'm cursed with the day that I was born. This man was depressed. And you can see why. And God has to constantly bring him back from his depression. Now, one of the other things I just want to look at this morning on the prophet to the nations, in Jeremiah's mission. It's impressive to know that side of Jeremiah when you get into the feel of Jeremiah, what it would be like to be him. Because none of us could ever say we've been asked to do more than that. You really think about that. In your ecclesial life, when has anybody treated you like that in ecclesial life? I mean, our road that God has asked us to take is not that extreme. And we haven't even got to the end of Jeremiah. We just looked at some of the highlights. But Jeremiah is there to remind all of us, brothers and sisters, we can do it by God's grace. And we do. And this is what God wants us to do in the ecclesia. But you look at this idea of the prophet to the nations back in chapter 1 at verse 5. That phrase used to puzzle me because I wonder, like, why would Jeremiah be a prophet to the nations? But what he was doing, his message to the Gentile nations was, God wanted to make sure somebody made it very clear. He wasn't just a prophet to the Jews. Jeremiah's message was going to go out beyond the land. It was going to go up into Babylon. It was going to go down into Egypt. It was going to go to all the nations around Israel, that Yahweh, the God of Israel, who had brought his people up from the land of Egypt and had given them the land of Canaan, Yahweh was removing them from the land. And he had to make that message clear. So Jeremiah is springing out of Jerusalem this message. Daniel's up in Babylon doing the same thing. The Most High rules in the kingdoms of men and gives it to whomsoever he wills. Daniel wants to make it clear to the Babylonian kings, your gods didn't beat Yahweh. He took his people out of the land. Jeremiah is saying the same message down in the south because God cared that the people of the world realize that Yahweh had not been beaten at all. Nobody had beaten Yahweh. Bel had not beat him. Nebo had not beat him. But Yahweh had removed his people from the land because the people were so bad. And what better man to deliver that message than a man who was so committed to the people that he would give his life for these people? And this is the man who's delivering the message that Yahweh has to remove his people from the land. And then in turn, he delivers the message that the nations themselves will be destroyed as well. And that's part of the... That's part of Jeremiah's message. Well, that's the beginning on this story of Jeremiah. We'll hopefully look at some of the more detail as the week goes on. But I hope you can see there's going to be a lot of fun things to look at and a lot of great family and ecclesial lessons in our studies of Jeremiah.